This is Charlottesville Tomorrow, an advocate for our future today. Charlottesville Tomorrow is a nonpartisan community organization working on land use, transportation, and community design issues. Visit us on the web at seavilletomorrow.org.
In 1974, the Charlottesville City Council made a decision that led to the transformation of the city's central business district. To generate more business downtown, council voted to convert East Main Street into a pedestrian mall. The Charlottesville Downtown Mall was dedicated in 1976. In 2010, three of the people who were on council in 1974 gathered in City Space to talk about the early days of the mall as part of an exhibit sponsored by the Charlottesville Community Design Center. Charles Barber, Francis Fife, and George Gillum all spoke at a panel discussion held Monday, April 12, 2010. The event was moderated by Sarita Herman, a graduate student in architectural history at UVA.
Welcome, everyone, and I'd like to thank you all for coming today to participate in this discussion about the mall's early history. We're going to focus on the City Council, which was the driving political force in bringing a pedestrian mall to Charlottesville. It was an extremely historically important council in shaping the way we understand Charlottesville today, not just because of the mall project, but also because of their support of desegregating the city government and improving many social and civic institutions in Charlottesville. With us today are three of the five council members who made the decision to bring a pedestrian mall to Charlottesville.
We didn't.
On the far edge, Mr. Francis Fife, Charles Barber in the center, and George Gillum. Thank you all for volunteering to talk with us today. Really happy to have you here. In a moment, I'm going to give you a chance to introduce yourselves, but I'd like to take a minute to say a few words about the two council members that are not here today, Jill Reinhart and Mitchell Vanyaris. Mrs. Reinhart had hoped to be here today. I just heard from her a few days ago, and she had to cancel. However, I recently had the pleasure of sitting down with Mrs. Reinhart to talk about the mall, and I'd like to share some of the insights that she shared with me. Mrs. Reinhart is a really important figure in Charlottesville's history as the first woman to serve on the city council. She spent her childhood in St. Louis, Missouri, Beverly Hills, California, and New York City. She moved to Charlottesville in 1940 at the age of 19 after marrying Bill Reinhart. As a young bride, she wanted to continue her education here, but she was denied entry to the University of Virginia because they did not accept women at the time. Over the next 30 years, she raised a family with her husband Bill and became an important part of the community here. She got involved with politics in the Democratic Party during the 1960s, and in 1972, she ran for city council at the age of 51. As the first woman on city council, she pioneered the way for other women to serve important roles within our city government. Though she was not able to vote on the initial mall decision, like a couple other of the people who are here today, she has gone on the record as being strongly in favor of the decision, and her other legacy from her time on council was playing a major role in the transformation of the old McGuffey School into the McGuffey Arts Center, which she continued to work with for many years here in Charlottesville. And the other council member who is not here with us today is Mr. Mitchell Vanyaris, who passed away in 2008 at the age of 81. After serving on city council, Mr. Vanyaris went to serve in the Virginia House of Delegates from 1981 to 2005. And he can be credited for leading the initiative to return housing to the downtown area in Charlottesville during the 1980s and 1990s. And I never had the opportunity to speak with Mr. Vanyaris, but I'm sure his name will come up plenty from our other council members that are here to talk to us today because of his crucial role as one of the two council members that actually approved the decision to go ahead with the mall at Charlottesville. Okay. Why don't we start with some introductions, and maybe we'll start... with Mr. Francis Fife.
Well, I'm Francis Fife, lifelong resident of this community and lifelong Democrat, and I've enjoyed living. It's the greatest place in the world, and I've enjoyed living here. Never wanted to move anywhere else. I was away for 4 years during the late unpleasantness in Europe, and then came back and got interested in a lot of civic affairs, and at some point ran for the city council, and there were actually three candidates. I was an independent Democrat. There were two seats, and I came in third. So it took me 20 years to recover from that. Then the Democrats came and asked me to run. So I did. That's enough.
Charles? My name is Charles Baldwin. I was born and raised in Elmont County, Charlottesville. And I went to a segregated school in the county until 1962. Then I went to Burley in 1958, which was a segregated black school. And I got involved in politics in the early 60s, late 50s. I was with the NAACP voters registration. I get blacks registered to vote. No blacks ever served on city council. So we had a big to-do about getting people registered to vote. And I was a campaign chairman for the fire precinct, and three guys came by to see me one night and they brought me to city council. And I says, gosh, when did you get a teacher or a preacher or somebody, you know? And I'm a nurse. I worked at the University of Virginia. They stayed so long, I'm not sure I ever said yes. I just got out of the They stayed so long and talked, I think I would just go. They say, okay. So I said, if I'm nominated, I would serve. So Francis and I was nominated, so we served together, and the rest of history.
Mm-hmm. I'm George Gillum, and I was the newcomer to the group. I arrived here in 1965 to attend law school, graduated in 68, and got active in civic affairs, and was elected with Jill Reinhart, Mitch Van Yeres, and I were elected in 1972. And all of us had expressed interest in the idea of doing something dramatic with downtown. I don't think that any of us have terribly well-formed idea, but we all knew that we needed to do something in the heart of the city to save it. If I may, before we get too deeply involved in sort of what went into the mall, I would like to point out some other very important initiatives that this council took under Francis's leadership from 72 to 74, and then Charles's leadership from...
And Mitch before that.
And Mitch before that. We converted McGuffey School from an unused empty school building into the Arts Center. We privatized the bus system. There were no city school buses when we were elected to office. And we established both the school bus and the city transit lines. It used to be the kids who were going to take a school bus had to pay 25 cents, I think, each way. We did a lot of, we did the recreation centers, the public swimming pools. So we did a lot of things in addition to the mall, but I think we all look back on the mall as sort of the thing that we are the proudest of because of the contribution that it made to saving the center of the city.
Oh, let me go back to the swimming pools, because when we came on council in 1970, this council had decided to build one swimming pool at Penn Park. And we were trying to figure how could the average poor person get to Penn Park? There had no transportation. So that was a big to-do, so we, the council, decided to do away with that plane, we came up with local swimming pools. So there we have one throughout the city. We have two indoors and three indoors. And I was fortunate enough to dedicate those swimming pools in 1975, 76.
Would you like to say something about the desegregation that was also going on in the city?
Well, when we came on council, this council gets an awful lot of credit for making all of the changes that we have today. No councils since 70, during our term, have made as many changes that affect the city.
And spend as much money.
We had money to spend, and we had money to spend, and we done a lot of good for the city. One thing we done was blacks could only live in the core of the city. because the former planning commission and the council in the past, the history of Charlottesville, had designated black live only in this pre-designated center of the city. At the same time, I could have my house here, and you could come and build a garage next door. If you look around the city today, in the core of the city, you see a nice house, then you see a service station or a store. We changed that so that blacks could live in the place they wanted to. I was one of the first blacks to live right at the core of the city into a white neighborhood. After I moved, it's amazing. Everybody deserted the place. But I was the first to live there. And one day I was, this guy called me, asked me to join the JCs. I was the first black to join the JCs. So it was Republicans, a friend of mine. The Republican asked me, I didn't realize the Republican at the time, he asked me to join the JC. I went to join the JC for 3 years. So that was a real experience. But the same place, we used to hold that meeting at Fried Spring Beach Club. It was a segregated place. And the city would have their affairs there with dances and things, Christmas and things. And black could go to dance and participate. But blacks could not become a member to join the pool of whatever. So that was it. That had to change. So we changed that the city could no longer go to Fried Spring, help them stay segregated, and using city money. I had a daughter. I lived about half a mile from Fried Spring when after I moved right to the core of the city. And this lady next door took my daughter, about 12, up to the Fried Spring swimming pool. They thought she couldn't come in. The lady really didn't know. She was a very nice lady, a friend of ours. So, you know, that sort of got my attention before I got on City Hills.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's start talking about the mall. who brought the idea?
Charlie Mills.
Yeah,
my name.
Sure.
You're talking about Fried Spring. Mm-hmm. I remember having when I had dances there a year ago for a Superior Estate Farm, different place.
Yeah.
The former owner of the place, if you hadn't gone there, they had a band, I think it was a white band, both of the players there one night for a dance. But they had one black member of the band. All right. When time came for intermission break, they got to go take a break. They wouldn't let the black member use the restroom.
What?
All right. Oh. Things have changed.
I'm sorry.
Now that was about the mall.
Oh, my goodness. Well, let me say one thing about the mall.
Sure.
I see the mail sitting back up. Hi, Mr. Mayor. Let me say, from the get-go of the mall, I always felt we needed a public restroom downtown. Fraser heard this story so many times. So many senior citizens would come to me and say, "We have no place to go downtown to the restroom." Well, the stores, a lot of department stores had bathrooms, but no public place. If you went shop, and sometimes you couldn't get in, some of the restaurants you couldn't get in, blacks couldn't get in. And it always bothered me, and I want to thank the council for having the public bathroom there about 50, 40 years later, but it's here. That's what I'm saying.
That's so who brought the idea of a mall to the council at first, and why was it supported or why was it needed?
Well, I would guess that it was George Gillum and Cole Hendricks, the city manager, and Mitch Fanieres, who was a senior member of the council. I think they got back in the background. I was mayor, and they were conniving. They didn't tell me anything. And we went off on a retreat, and we were quickly told that we had to take a reporter with us because we couldn't have a meeting of more than two members of council together if we didn't. So we went off, and this idea came up, and it was a very enticing idea. I must say, as I thought about it, I thought, well, you know, I'm not much, but I'm a little bit older than these guys. I was a bit concerned about possibly losing some of the old businesses that had been around for a long time and everybody knew and so on. But it sounded like a very attractive idea. And we got to discussing it. And one day I got a call from a guy named George Gillum. And he said, you can't vote on tomorrow. And I said, what? He said, you can't vote on tomorrow. You have a conflict of interest. And I said, I do. What's my conflict? Well, it turned out that if you made more than $5,000 a year, and if you worked on a business on the mall, that was one of the things that you excluded. Well, I think I made $5,025 a year. It wasn't like the salaries that you see in the paper for bankers these days. I worked in the bank right down the street, People's Bank. And I could hardly believe what George said. And then it turned out that he said he was disqualified himself. And then it turned out that Jill Reinhardt was disqualified. So that left Charles and Mitch to carry on. You can't, you're not supposed to favor it or anything. I mean, I could ask questions and conduct the meetings and that sort of thing, but I could not set the stage.
I think the context of the early 1970s Charlottesville is important to understand. At that time, there were three banks in Charlottesville, and only three. And there may be a couple of savings and loan associations. But the banks acted as trustees for the estates of a lot of the old families that owned the property, the stores up and down the mall. And they were worried, as corporate citizens as well as trustees for the estates of the people who own the property, about the rotting away of the core of the city. There was a legitimate fear that the core of the city was going to end up like, you know, Petersburg or so many cities that have just given way to the suburbs. And so I think that really the earliest discussions for doing something dramatic about the city probably originated with those banks. Al Clements, who was president of one of the banks, was a friend of mine and talked to me about it at the time I was running for the city council. And my family is from Petersburg. I knew what happened when the center of a city fell apart. And so I was very interested in avoiding that in Charlottesville. But in any event, as we worked for a year and a half on the mall, and we all were strongly in favor of it, I think, until this issue of the conflicts came up. Now, the issue of conflicts was very interesting because it was raised, of course, by people who were opposed to the city doing anything on the mall. And their fear was that doing something like we were talking about doing would ruin the downtown. In order to allege that anybody had a conflict, they had to, in effect, allege that we were feathering our own nest. My law firm represented one of the banks and earned more than $5,000 a year from the bank. So since I was a member of the firm and, you know, had a tiny little slice of that $5,000, I was stained. Francis was an employee of the bank, and Jill Reinhardt's husband was on the board of directors of the bank. And so that was deemed to stain all of us. And so we did all have to stay back out of it. But the centrality of the banks in the community and the interest that they had in the community is markedly different than what you see today when many of the banks are owned by out-of-town interests and are just part of the big conglomerate. these people did have, I think, a deep, genuine interest in preservation of the values in the community.
Let me go back a little bit on the mall. We went to a retreat, and there was many ideas presented to us. One idea was to have a half mall.
Yeah.
Have a half mall, half pedestrian mall, and transportation, and that was unacceptable. But we went up to Reston, Virginia to see their mall. We came back, and this idea was presented to us, so this is what we decided on. But for me, it was good to see the mall come in, because prior to the mall, I, as being a black person, had walked around the back of the Paramount Theater to get in. I didn't have to go around to the back in the mall, so I could have a brick to walk in the front door. So that was a good thing. I was for the mall. I knew something had to be done. Downtown was running down, which is terrible. And the mall, I thought, was a good idea. Mitch Van Yers, he isn't here, I speak for himself, but he held up on the mall for a good while. But I was for the mall from the get-go, because I thought it was a good idea. In this day, this mall belongs to all of us, because a black name and a white name signed it for the mall, so that is a good thing.
Well, just one little note. I saw the Attorney General of Virginia afterwards, and
it was a different attorney general.
Oh, not the one we have now. And I asked him, I said, Andy, why did you say I had a conflict of interest? And he said, well, the right thing. He said, because you did.
Okay, you talked a little bit about the retreat that you went on and looking at some other malls. Why Lawrence Halperin? Why the firm of Lawrence Halperin, which was the landscape architect that designed the mall?
I don't know who came to that
first. I think two or three decisions were made. As Charles pointed out, some had suggested that we do a scheme similar to what Denver has, what Winchester had. That was half the street bricked over, but still a line of traffic going through the other half. And after we looked at them, we decided that the only way to do this was in sort of a first-class way, using the best design, the best building materials, and so on. We pretty well knew that it was going to be politically very unpopular, because big change is always hard for people to get used to. And also, it was going to be expensive. In terms then, it was $3 or $4 million. That money today would probably be 6 or 8 times that. So it was very expensive, and there was heated public opposition. And you know, so we knew that, and we decided that if we were going to do it, we had to do it in a first class way. I think that Vern Ewart who was deputy city manager at the time, or assistant city manager at the time, was the one who actually looked at the work of a number of landscape architecture firms, and came up with the short list of firms that should be interviewed. And Lawrence Halperin Associates was, I thought, clearly the class of the bunch. Absolutely first-class projects nationally, internationally, from Israel to San Francisco, Minneapolis, and they did a great presentation, and they seemed to have a good handle on what the political process had to be, that we had to spend time, even though, you know, the council could have voted for it, we needed to spend time sort of preparing the public for it and getting the public involved in it. And so we did that for a year and a half, probably, before any decisions were made.
You can remember one of the individual things that happened was when the young men's shop head man was one of the leaders of the opposition. And Harry Romanski had always been a great supporter of the government and so on, and as a matter of fact, he supported it in the end. I mean, he said, "Well, if you're going to vote for it, I will support it." But he was opposed to it. So Mitch said, well, let's go look at one. They went up somewhere in Maryland and looked at one. When he came back, I met Mitch, and I said, well, how'd you do? He said, well, I came back confirmed in the way I believed, and so did Harry. But once we decided, he then supported it. He was a great citizen.
Max Baldwin
was against
it too, wasn't he?
Who?
Max
Baldwin.
He used to be down in Vegas.
Yeah, yeah. I don't
know. I think we had a public hearing towards the end of the process over in the Armory, what's now the Recreation Center. And we had a sign-up sheet, and we hoped that there would be a relatively equal number of people for it and against it. So the idea was that the mayor would call on people alternating from these two lists. Zero signed up to speak in favor. Zero.
Well, tell them about Clements and his part in it.
Well, one of the bankers, Alvin Clements, we decided to set up what we call the Central City Commission to talk about ideas for the Central City. And Alvin was named chairman of this. And that group, which was 30 people, pretty broadly cross-representative of the larger community, all geographic areas, all racial, ethnic, religious, income groups represented, met on a number of occasions to consider ideas for them all, and were very active participants. And finally, when Lawrence Halperin came in, one of the things he wanted very much for us to do was to try to see the downtown in ways that we hadn't seen it. And so they put together a retreat weekend. What was that? You had the name.
The Take Part Workshop.
Take Part Workshop. And there were 30 or 40 of us, all the members of City Council, plus this Central City Commission, met for a weekend, and we were given a number of exercises to go out and do things in the city that caused us to view the city through really different eyes than we had therefore used. And out of this came a real consensus from this group of key people around the community that this was something that we needed to do. Unfortunately, not all of them were willing to speak up in public. But their participation was very important. We did things like we had to turn in all of our money, watch, everything when we arrived at this. And we were given $1 a day to feed ourselves on. And
you could get a pretty good lunch.
Yeah, but not three meals, three squares. We thought about getting ourselves put in jail because that would get us three squares a day. But what we figured out was we had to combine our resources, and we had to, instead of going to the Nook or someplace, we had to go to a grocery store and buy groceries and make what it was that we were going to eat. Well, then we discovered that there were no grocery stores down here at that time. And so we decided, you know, we got to do something to encourage a grocery store. If we're going to have people living in the downtown area, we got to have stuff. The private sector was also important. One of the great people in Charlottesville at that time is a woman named Mary Ann Elwood, who many of you know. She was president of the Chamber of Commerce, and she and her husband, Bill, and another couple bought two or three buildings at the far end of the mall and built apartments. And they were the first ones to build residential apartments on the mall. And they attracted some university faculty members and perhaps some students. But that was a very important part of the shift, was to try to get people living in the downtown area. And, you know, that was done by the private sector. It would not have been done had the government not laid the foundation for it, but it was evidence, I think, of a good public-private working relationship at that time. Sally?
Yeah.
I remember that the mall was ripped over for a ways and then stopped. And then people got used to it, and even some of the opponents decided to think. But what I've always been curious about was that your plan from the beginning, or was that...
Well, the plan from the beginning went further, went really up to the top of Vinegar Hill, up to... most recently was a rental place up there, was Russell Mooney Oldsmobile back at that time. But Francis mentioned Harry Omansky. Harry threatened to sue us.
Yeah.
And that's why we stopped them all short of where the Young Men's Shop was. And then once it was built, he became a true believer. He got religion at that point. And then, I don't know if he threatened to sue it, but he didn't extend it, but he reversed his position.
So it wasn't your plan from the beginning to do it in pieces?
No.
No.
It was more expensive to do it in pieces. These things are, you always save money by doing it right from the beginning. If you try to break it up, you end up spending a lot more money.
All right, well, I'd like to open it up to questions now. If anybody wants to say anything, or if any of you wants to volunteer any information that we haven't gone over thus far.
I'm curious if you see parallels between the discussion that we've been reading in the paper about promoting Parkway through Magnetic Park to save downtown, which is just sort of the opposite idea of what happened during the mall, which was taking automobiles out of downtown was what was going to save downtown. Now it's the idea of bringing automobiles into downtown that's going to save downtown. I'm curious what parallels and anti-parallels, whatever, orthogonal points you might come up with that would relate those two projects.
Francis?
Well, I should have known Peter was going to ask this question.
That's why I ducked it.
As he knows, I'm opposed to the Meadow Creek Parkway, and it may bring some business into downtown, but my feeling is it'll be a pathway out to Pantops, maybe a better pathway than they have now, maybe a worse, and a pathway over to 64. So I don't know whether you're talking about our views.
I think more about the politics of who the actors are, and it would appear that the Chamber of Commerce is clearly an advocate for the McIntyre Road Extended and other projects. And I'm just curious about whether they were non-advocates as a group or advocates back in the day of the mall decisions, so whether the business community has totally flipped on this, or whether they're consistent, and just sort of how the various groups interact.
I don't remember the Chambers taking a position as such, but
they did. There were a lot, most of the stores downtown, many of those have now relocated out to one of the shopping centers in the county. So it was a different mix. Our prediction, based on what we had seen in other cities and what Lawrence Halpern told us, was that it would take 10 years for businesses who could not survive in this type of environment to realize that they couldn't survive and either fold or move, and for other sort of more boutique types of businesses to move in. And we knew that was going to happen. That there would be some who didn't make it in this environment. It actually took 20 years for that turnover to occur, and it didn't occur until after the city had made the additional investment in the hotel, and then the Danielson Group made their investment in the ice rink and the movie theaters. Without those components, I'm not sure that it ever would have, been what it is today. They brought a lot of people in.
The mall is growing, as you can see. It's living almost up to its potential, but if you look around, there's no blacks on the mall this day. Very low blacks. They are going to serve. You walk downtown right now, you see no blacks, no white. And I don't know why. Blacks have not fared as well as the mall have fared. That's what's concerned.
So I'll tell you my own personal opinion. I've been here all my life, born right here. As far as that's concerned, not only blacks, but I think your average white person cannot afford to come downtown tomorrow.
You may be right, but if you rich white or poor white, you're still white.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, my point is, blacks have not failed as well. They don't. You don't see no serve on their side. You know, you go downtown right now, everybody look nice. They serve food. You don't see a black person on their side doing anything. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to be rich to do that.
Virginia.
My memory isn't as good as any of yours. But I'm thinking back to when certain stores disappeared, like Nugget and Jason Reed's. Williams and what? Yes.
And Miller Rose.
Yeah. And so, Lexbury one.
Well, you know, Miller Rose closed because they had a restaurant on the
top floor,
and blacks couldn't go in, so they rather close the rest of the store than admit blacks.
When this whole project
I don't
began.
Know. But they moved to Barracks Road at first.
Yes. When this whole project began. I didn't have a sense to be concerned about what was going to happen in that direction. But very quickly, it became apparent to me that we were losing all the businesses that served poor people.
That is so true.
All of them. You couldn't go downtown and buy a pair of undershorts for your kids, or just the simplest things, just to buy six pairs of socks to start school with, or notebooks. They weren't there. None of this was there. There were no cheap places to eat. They were all expensive. There was no grocery store. Reed's was down here. I don't remember when Reed's burned and when it left.
Right.
At least it burned.
Reed's burned around 1980.
Yeah, that was a terrible blow to the people who might be able to shop with nothing more than a grocery cart and not have to go out to parking lots.
This day, Mr. Mayor said it like that. Mr. Mayor, I'd like to say, I would like to see, and for the people who said here, for the lady just talking, we need a department store downtown. I know you can't do it by yourself. I'm making a statement, public statement. We need a department store downtown. You're going to have department store. You have parking under the building, and people upstairs. You have boutique shops upstairs. We need a department store downtown for just what the lady just said.
But we don't need just any department store.
The city would bring just anyone in. They'll bring the right type thing in. But we need a department store downtown, at least one.
But I wonder if, since there's so much subsidy was given to the Omni, if anybody ever considered giving money to something that would keep the economically deprived population, and many of them blacks, from coming down to the downtown mall and feeling like a full participant. Did the council ever think about subsidizing anything except the Fancy Hotel?
Well, our council was not the one that subsidized the Fancy Hotel, although I will say I think that was a necessary component.
I don't think that there is
any council that built more housing units that were placed in small clusters around the city than ours did. We were extremely active in providing. We called it scattered site housing, where we put 4 units, 6 units, 8 units, and we did what was the at that time thought to be the wise thing to do, and that was to put housing that was probably going to be occupied by lower income blacks into largely white neighborhoods. That was really popular.
But Francis,
you know, during his public career, has been the real champion of providing housing that's affordable for everybody in our community. And Francis wouldn't let us do anything until we had addressed that, issue. So that was done pretty well.
One of the interesting things was we decided to put them in 4 different areas, the next housing units, so that if somebody came to us and said, "You can't put that in my neighborhood," you'd say, "Oh, yes, we are." And we're putting them in everybody's neighborhood, so don't worry about it.
You remember, Francis, that I wanted you to put it on Park Street where the Baptist Church took one? Well, that's where I was living.
That's near where your house is.
Yeah.
I want to tie this together because George earlier on made a statement that Alfred had said that some types of businesses would survive and some wouldn't. And you used the word boutique, and that is sort of what's happened, and that's part of this discussion we're having. But was that really recognized at the time that this would become a row of boutiques?
I think so. Yeah, I think it was.
Trying to get smaller, New York City.
No, the trend at that time was very definitely that the big shopping centers were giving the big department stores dollar square foot per year rent as a way of getting them to come in as anchors. We knew that we couldn't, and downtown couldn't, number one, provide the space, the square footages that the suburban malls were providing, and, you know, couldn't provide the customer base. And so those, the Leggetts, the Miller and Rhodes, the stores like that, they weren't going to stay downtown no matter what was down here. And so the decision we had was, how do we create an environment that will get some retail activity down here? Although we knew it was not going to be, it was not going to be the types of stores that I think Charles and many people miss.
Unfortunately, our council, we didn't pursue a department store downtown at the time. We were so involved with the mall, all of the store down here was in the process of moving out. But we look at hindsight 2020, the nice head we pushed hard to maintain or get someone to stay downtown. So that's our mistake.
What was your question, Beth?
I had a question about this issue of the public nature of the mall, but before that I just wanted to mention that the urban design plan that Halperin did, and that was part of the contract with the city, included High Street down to Monticello Road and Belmont Bridge over to Jefferson School. And it was mixed use, and it was housing and retail and commercial. We have the original drawings over at the architecture school for the rest of the month, but there are some reproductions in the show if you want to see that. And they clearly understood that Main Street would change in character, but I'm struck by how urbane their vision was. I would have liked to have thought it was a 20-year vision. I think it's probably more 50 to 75. But it's helpful, I think, to look at that because the mall was one street out of, a 20-block area that they were envisioning rebuilding. Mm. The question is though, back to this issue of who is the mall for, and it relates to one of the surprises that Sarita and the other research assistants and I had when we were at the Halperin Archives and we were going through the construction drawings. And we realized that there were originally 150 freestanding movable chairs and benches on the mall that you could sit in for as long as you wanted, for as little money as you had. And there's only 30 right now. And they're not flexible. They're all screwed into the ground. So I'm wondering, was there any discussion initially about the idea of flexible seating? Was that a scary thing? Was that just a good idea?
No, there was a lot of flexible seating, yeah. And I don't remember exactly when it was reduced, but there was, I think the merchants on the mall were very concerned about people who were taking up permanent residence. And that was scaring off retail trade. So I think the decision was made maybe 10 years after the mall was built,
that
it was reduced. Yes. I mean, there was a lot more seating and so on for the first few years, anyway.
It occurs to me that's a signal about whether it's public for all or public for some, right? Public toilets, one thing, public seating.
Yeah. Mm. Well, the mayor's going through the same arguments now, I think, really. With
just a minute, his hand up.
You had your hand up in the back.
Most of the pedestrian malls that were built in this country were eventually torn up and reverted to vehicular freeways. Why do you think we stuck with it? You said you envisioned a 10-year transition period, and there being a lot longer than that. There was a time before the Omni was built when it looked like it was a failure. Why did they stick with it?
After we built it, we were stuck. We had no choice. We couldn't take the bricks up and start all over again, I don't think. Then we were stuck. That's the reason. And hoping that things would improve, and they have. But that's the reason.
Well, maybe, you know, I understand I may be wrong. But I understand it all. You say it all. Yeah. Along with the same time, built it more. It didn't work. It went back to the old way.
Well, the old way for Charlottesville would have been, and we'd be building the mall, there were a lot of vendors was closing. It looked like a dump. And it would have been worse if something hadn't happened. Something had to happen to make things better downtown. Now, even though the mall took a long time to catch on, but the brick and mortar was here, and it was a nice place to come. But at that time, it was a great place to come to. My complaint at the time that like the department store closed up at 5 o'clock. You know, a working person, how can you come to a store, the shop, if the store closed up at 5 o'clock? That was always concerned about.
That problem still exists.
Yeah. But things have improved. You can eat almost any time, any place. The mall now is a big food court. You get what you want, whatever you want. So that happens to be the way it is.
Right. Well, you know, the other thing to keep in, many of you here know this much better than we do, but when something like Fashion Square is developed, there's more square footage in Fashion Square than there is in all of downtown. Mm-hmm. And that was built in...
80.
Yeah, but it, probably an 18-month start to finish, totally leased up, all of that. Those stores that will go into an environment like that are not the stores that are going to come down here. They work on, you know, what the population is within a 3-mile radius and the population that shops at most of the stores there. There was not the concentration down here that there is in the close-in subdivisions. And so, you know, we were never going to compete for those stores once those trends were firmly fixed. It was just...
Well, yeah. Those places too, they got parking places.
They got a lot of parking, and yeah. People get used to going in. But we had to wait. We knew that at some point, at least I think we knew, that at some point people were going to want to live down here. And getting people to live down here was very, very important to the success of it. And there have been a lot of neighborhoods have been... substantially changed, redeveloped, and so on, close in. And it would not have succeeded without people living down here, I don't think.
There's been a question in the back for a minute.
I'm curious if any of the landscape architects and architects who have considered thought of a different concept from just a single linear mall, whether they might have cross street mall or parallel streets or some opportunity for having more than just this linear concept. Did any of them present that as an idea, and was there consideration of that?
I don't know.
Having been through the Halperin archives in Philadelphia recently, I can tell you that Lawrence Halperin actually developed several options, including all of the possibilities that you mentioned, and then they worked those over and discussed them and settled on the idea of a completely devoted pedestrian mall. But they had proposals for all sorts of different things at first and then weeded them out.
There's some diagrams of them in the show.
I haven't seen the show yet.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a question?
Yes, I did. It was mentioned perhaps the department stores being one option. What other options would you care to venture out on as far as those that we might want to look at in years moving forward to sustain the viability of the downtown?
The department store is one thing, and a grocery store, the people that come to me and ask me about it, you know, I'm the wrong person because I'm no longer on council. The planning commission belongs in the association, but a department store, if you have a department store and a grocery store in the same building, on these floors or something, there could be a creative way of doing this, but it could be downtown because
people have to travel to different places to shop. She just said about some socks or something, you have to go where? No place to buy anything downtown. That's just a, I don't have the perfect idea. I have the idea. I don't have the exact concept. I know what it would be like, how nice it would be. That's all. Just trying to get people downtown. That's all.
How are we doing on time?
Got
about 10 minutes. All right. We'll keep going. A question? Yes.
Well, I can ask a question.
Go ahead.
When I describe Charlottesville to friends, I say sometimes that we have actually two downtowns. We have this downtown and we have the corner.
That's right.
And they're, I think they're very distinct hubs and centers of the city. What would you do today if you were on council to try to connect those?
It would be nice if somehow we could attract university students downtown. But if, as you said, they're complete because of the university and the student, that makes all the difference in the world.
Well, when I come downtown and see a ton of young people down here, I think most of them are students.
On Friday night? Out there at the fan?
Huh?
And you have the fan?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
But and I'm talking about in the evening.
Oh, yeah.
They come to the movie theater, they come downtown, like you said, the evening to eat, or go to the bars, or what have you. And now the Dozen Theater is reopened with the nightclub sort of thing, so you go.
I think
a lot of people come downtown for that.
Yeah, we talked a lot about the barbell.
In some ways, you could say that the mall has been successful. It's certainly got these defects, in particular the ones that Charles mentioned. And of course, a lot of malls have gone out of business throughout the country.
But we're fortunate; a lot of cities have sent representatives here to see our mall. Mm-hmm. We have one of the best malls around, he said, in Mississippi. But at the same time, we have continued to make improvement. Don't get me wrong, everything I said about the mall is great. I'm not criticizing, making a statement. But we have one of the best malls around.
Does anyone know about the future of the eyesore down at Corner Station Mall?
But the mayor knows.
Of course, not a lot that's out of our hands.
Now, we're 10, 20 years, might look like does now.
You could set it up as a tourist attraction.
I don't understand why that huge building could have been considered a possibility for success when a medium scale department store, medium scale grocery store, couldn't have it, particularly if the parking doesn't disappear, it's already there. But there are a lot of people who can walk to do those things. A lot of them. And more and more people are interested in smaller scale presentations.
There is a small grocery store up on Market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's not going to be one that somebody is looking to save a little money is going to go to.
Right.
Move Reed's up a couple blocks.
Yeah. Mm. Sorry, David.
Like I say, you lost Reed's, you lost Nate's, you lost Sears. You lost the Sears moved to West Main before they moved to Fashion Square. Mm-hmm. And my family's business had to get off involved, which was the Yellow Kid business. Mm-hmm. They had a little pickup. Mm-hmm. And great people come by and get a kid in time they want to. But once that, they went to the foot of Bunker Hill, and until they completed the area up to the top of the Omni, our cars would come down the hill, pick up people, go around and buy a fish market. But then they closed off that business had to move off the mall. My late wife had a beauty shop downtown. She had to move because people couldn't get to it.
There are a lot of things that didn't make sense in the context of the research we were doing. It's great to hear the story getting filled out by the oral history that Sarita's been doing with you individually in conversation today. One thing that I realize that we haven't heard anything about in the course of the research is what reactions were in the middle of construction drawings when the fire occurred on the mall. Because that's the way I understand it, Central Place was going to be a block over on the other side of the Paramount, and then the buildings where Central Place is now burned in the middle of the drawings being done.
Was that an event that seemed to derail the project, or did everyone just say move Central Place and don't worry about it?
There was a decision that was made very quickly, very easily.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it avoided any notion of having to go through condemnation and do any of that. So I think there was a small restaurant, kind of a greasy spoon place there. There was a kitchen fire and it started.
Yeah.
That's what.
Right.
Yeah.
What was in this block where the parking garage was located?
This was done a few years before.
Gosh, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Yeah, Shaw's little barbershop was in here. Ed Shep at the Grand Hill Masters now. Mm. Had the green door, which was a restaurant. You remember the green door, don't you?
I do.
Okay. Green door, the barbershop, Mama Shaw Drugs, right here on this corner, Fifth.
That's right.
Herman had a barbershop up on Fifth Street behind the Montreal Road. Mm. Because like I was telling that lady earlier, years ago, State Hall was right there at Fifth and Market where you paid your utility bills, where the tasting is now.
Right.
And then you had the recreation center and police station. And I'm trying to think what else in this park. Oh, before they did away with the bridge and everything, the old bridge, they had a golf station down here. Golf station, automobile park, they should come around to where you go up what is now 7th Street, around that corner. As a golf station there, and Funk's Taxi Cab had a little station there, office, and then had the green door and a barbershop and Marshall Drug. I forget what else was in this block. But those were some of them here. That's been some years ago.
The barbershop, that one we call Monticello Xanadu?
Yeah,
that's the one that went.
That was a man by the name of Herman had that. But I'm thinking about the barbershop with the edge over here.
Yeah, I know.
I'm teaching around Masters now.
Trip down memory lane.
Yeah. You think of the changes downtown, think about 29 North. O'Reilly was just a country years ago. Mm. And over where Four Seasons is, that was over Blue Ridge Golf Course. Mm. Back in the 50s, Barrett Grove shop there wasn't nothing but a pack of wood.
Yeah.
It
was a farm.
It was two lanes, huh?
It was a farm.
Yeah.
And Carol's tea room. No Carol, no tea, no room.
That's right.
If there was any consideration about historic preservation issues of downtown mall buildings at the time, if there was an idea that bigger buildings might be needed to support a rebirth of downtown, was that going to be a problem in terms of reworking historic fabric on the downtown mall? Was that ever discussed as part of the maybe the conflict? Build, people will come, lose historic fabric. Is that an issue that was discussed?
We spent part of the weekend exercise. Each of us had to draw a block. And none of us were artists. I mean, these were awful. You think four-year-old drawings, I mean, that's about the level.
But I've seen a copy of your drawing.
It did make us look, you know, a lot more intently at the second and third stories of the existing buildings that I think all of us said, boy, there's stuff there that we just never noticed. And some really beautiful features. And I think we're all very aware of the beauty, but we were also so desperate to get something going that if somebody had come in and said, I want to knock down this in order to build, you know, a big store, a big building, I think frankly, the attitude at that time was build it.
Yep, that's exactly right.
With your accumulated wisdom, are you concerned about the future of the mall now with some storefronts closed? Or is that just
I think it's just cyclical. I think it's well established. I think the pedestrian patterns are good. You know, it is never going to be a mall like Fashion Square or something like that. Yeah, it's always going to be different than that.
How would you change it if you had the authority to work on it?
Well, that's another project.
I am ready.
Yeah, just, well, correct me if I'm wrong, but if I remember, I just come to Charlottesville at that time, and everybody was saying the country was in a rather good recession. Mm-hmm. And all this was being planned, and weathered that, and has weathered a few other recessions along. Mm-hmm. So that's something to keep in perspective. So I think comparatively, I think it's in pretty good shape. It revives itself, as long as people keep thinking ahead and thinking creatively. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The amount of private investment that has come to downtown in the last 20 years, is enormous. And that's a very good sign that private folks are willing to invest the money. That means that there are people who, you know, who've got some vision, who believe in what they're doing here now. And I think the city council now is well positioned to, you know, to take advantage of that.
And I'm sure that the city is actively trying to recruit for business downtown. There's got to be somebody responsible, you know. I'm sure that is going on. Right on, Mr. Mayor.
I know y'all remember back when the old Lafayette was down there where York Place is now. Lafayette. And there was some talk some time ago about the fact that the Three Stooges had come here to the Joseph. But that wasn't so. They came to Lafayette because that's long. 1947.
I thought you were going to say they were sitting up here at this table.
That was in 1947. And they had, if you wanted to, you had your picture taken with them. Went back on Water Street. I did it. So Four Stooges there. But, and of course, back in the day, they had not only them, but had other cowboy stars there from time to time in person.
Oh, yeah.
And had it everywhere. All cartoons, showed up with cartoons all day long. And had the serials, or continued pictures, you know. I remember going to Lafayette, it opened up at 10:45 on Saturday morning's matinee. You go in there, and kids under 12 years of age, you get in for 12 cents. It's got a good box of popcorn, a dime, 15, something like that. And if you wanted to, you'd go in there and sit there all afternoon long, watch movies over and over again. You wouldn't have to get up and come out after every show. And Paramount wasn't, Paramount wasn't but 52 cents for adults. Mm-hmm. And that best box popcorn thing.
Mr. May?
We had a meeting in this very room a week or two ago with some current merchants downtown to talk about the future of the mall. But there's this still a strong sense in certain quarters down here that unless and until we put a camera system downtown, that the mall is never going to attract enough customers, that people want to feel safe. Wondering how you feel about that idea of having a public surveillance system downtown.
Well, you know, there are a lot of European cities that have got very big surveillance systems. A lot of U.S. cities have big surveillance systems, and they still have random acts of violence. I mean, you know, you don't avoid, it makes it easier to catch the people who did something, but they don't keep something bad from happening. And, you know, I think everybody who loves this mall has known that at some point, you know, there was going to be something. This is going to be a robbery, or this is going to be something, and that comes with urban life, unfortunately.
Well, when that idea brought up several years ago, and it didn't go along with people, invasion of crowds.
Right.
I mean, who would have thought that a couple looking at the sunset up on the Blue Ridge Parkway would be at risk? I mean, these things happen in.
Let me ask, Mr. Mayor, let me ask you a question. A lot of the business, have any business requested or concerned about cameras being in here? I'm just curious.
They're the ones that are requesting.
I'm talking to any new business who have some ideas. And do Prospect have mentioned that? Do you have Campbell? I'm just curious.
Oh, in terms of perspective, mm-hmm. I haven't.
But I think it's a good idea. I mean, whatever will work, I mean, don't hold back progress if things will work. I think it's a good idea. If you do nothing wrong, it makes no difference.
I was thinking about Jane Jacobs, the urbanist from the early 60s. If you have eyes on the street, she didn't mean cameras. She meant people living. That's right. When places feel safe. I think everything we can do to imagine a mixed use of downtown is going to make it safer. Okay. And that was Alfred's vision. Maybe that's a way to...
Yeah.
We really appreciate everybody coming. We're so appreciative of the three of you being here today. It's really...
It's great that you all are here today. So.
Thanks for coming.
Are you going to...
Hello?